One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome back to the Lozcast, or the Lawrence McKenna podcast. A lot of people listened last week, which was fantastic. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm joined again by my guest, Jamie Slovenia. I like it. It's good to have you. We had a good chat last week. We've kind of decided to make this into focused conversations, but like long form style, the kind of stuff that you could do on YouTube. But technically, like, do you really want to watch 40 minutes of me chatting on YouTube? Not really. Yeah. The point is, though, that like we are getting down to it today on, I would call like a, like there's obviously loads of politics surrounding the thing that we're trying to talk about. And I'm not really so interested in discussing the ins and outs, the morality of the whole thing. I'm interested in actually exploring why and how it's happening and what the actual implications of that are. Because let's just off the top, Saudi Arabia as a country is an incredibly rich place in the first place. I think the best thing we can do is unpack this, right? They've been incredibly oil rich for generations now. And that oil richness has allowed them a lot of benefits.
Yeah, it's allowed them to diversify.
Right.
Get a lot of money up front.
Yeah.
And the story of the last 20 years
yeah.
in terms of Saudi Arabia
yeah.
is economic diversification. But as we're going to discuss today, PR diversification.
And that PR aspect is like something that fascinates me. And to kind of give it a bit of an analogy is when you go to Hollywood or when you are, you know, becoming a big celebrity, as with The Idol at the moment on HBO, you have all the trappings of fame, which is essentially what Saudi Arabia have, right? They have the money, they have notoriety, they have links, they have connections, they have everyone throwing themselves at them for opportunities, because oil has been, still is, and probably for a little while will still be one of the biggest commodities on the planet, right?
Right, and in addition, they're geographically placed such that they become an information partner
right.
for the West when it comes to the Middle East. So right. they're sort of uniquely positioned, actually.
Yeah, and not only that, but historically they're kind of tied up with the West. I didn't want to get too... I mean, I don't care how political we get with it, but I don't want to get kind of politically judgy, if that makes sense. And what I would say is the West and the Middle East historically have what I would call quite a fraught relationship, but one which diplomatically has always had been made to have to work. So the West is kind of... at one point wasn't really all that involved in the Middle East. And then throughout the 20th century and probably a little bit before that became more and more ingrained in that area as they basically realized there was money to be made, as a lot of people probably did, but at the same time as they did. And this, the colonization of other countries during the 20th century and obviously before that, but the colonization of the Middle East was rampant. Weirdly, though, there were people at the top in the Middle East who were almost happy to oblige, is a fair way of putting it, right? And now, weirdly, in an almost flipped sort of, ironic scenario, the people at the top in Britain are almost weirdly happy to oblige the people in the Middle East who want to, and I'm not saying they're colonizing, but they are the powerful people coming in to own the structures, should we say, or the people.
Yeah, so you have this weird dynamic in both instances where you have quite strong moral judgments, west to east and east to west, about what constitutes moral. But then the incentives for the people right at the top aren't worried about that, and they have to pay lip service to it in the relevant ways. And you saw this with the World Cup in Qatar.
100%.
How we would be hugely investing in Qatar and in some ways supporting directly migrant workers. But on the public service BBC, the introduction to the World Cup program doesn't mention them.
Yeah.
And is critical. And you have this weird dynamic where on the one hand, we have to sell the idea of our version of morality, be it Saudi Arabian or British, and at the same time, totally be incentivized to cooperate in ways that are hugely profitable. And, you know, I heard someone describe Qatar's job as saying to the locals, hey, we're doing a really conservative World Cup. And to the West, hey, we're doing a really liberal World Cup.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the West has to actually play that game too.
Yeah.
In terms of their diplomatic and financial involvement. But also, hey, you're sports washing and we need to investigate this.
Yeah. And that's kind of the sports washing aspect kind of fascinates me, because I was very vehemently like banging the drum for sports washing years ago and probably do still feel quite similar. But I don't necessarily feel that I was always bang on, maybe because I didn't know all the information, or maybe as you learn more about a subject, you learn more. And what I learned was that I already knew it, but what I learned in the way that I try to frame it is all governments do terrible things. The Western governments do awful things. The Saudi Arabian government probably do. Like, there are many governments in the world that are not doing nice things, right? But that doesn't mean, and the real issue that I have so often is people currently kind of go, oh, well, then fix your own back garden before you fix anything else. And I'm sort of like, yeah, but as neighbors, it's almost like I own your rose bush, but you own my junipers or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Like, we all own a part of each other's garden. So the analogy there doesn't fit. Like, you can't fix your own house, get that in order, because half of your house is owned by the neighbor you have some fraud, like, who parks in your parking spot 3 out of 4 times a week.
Yeah. And the accusation, I guess the accusation that, hey, well, you're doing bad things too, therefore you can't pass any judgment. Look, you can make the argument. It's a very short conversation.
Yeah.
And the conversation ends with, yeah, well, both things are bad.
Yeah.
And if we're as interlocked as we are, and we clearly are with Saudi Arabia, you kind of do have to engage. And I view that criticism as just, hey, I don't want to engage.
Right, yeah. Yeah, right. I don't want to engage is a huge part of what our governments say, a huge part of what Saudi Arabian governments say, a huge part of what a lot of governments say.
My confusion, basically, with the sports washing criticism is we are already providing them the legitimacy and vice versa, mm-hmm. by having them be a huge trading partner, by having them being an intelligence partner. So therefore, the attention on sports washing as opposed to those relationships feels more like an exercise in paying lip service to moral values we may genuinely believe in, but seem to be unable to take action on in a more substantive way.
Right. And that is a real challenge, because at the same time, not to counter that, but to kind of, I guess, add to it, like, you can't sit there and, moralize about these things, and they can't sit there and moralize about these things, and then at the same time say, but we don't want to engage in them. So the West are terrible people and the East are terrible people, but I don't want to engage in that. I basically just want to bypass all that and go straight to the money, which is kind of what's happening in a sense. And so it's taken about 7 minutes to get to this kind of what most people would regard as quite a kind of boring top end conclusion, I imagine. But you've kind of got to unpack this stuff, at least from my perspective, before you unpack everything else. And there is quite an intertwined relationship between the two sets of people. I honestly don't actually think that Middle Eastern people and Western people are actually all that different on a public level. And I actually don't think they're all that different on a governmental level. And if anything, I think the government's probably learned a bit from each other on how to manage the populations, right?
Sure.
So there are clashes of culture, sure, which aesthetically seem very broadly different, right? So Islam appears very different from Christianity, what most people would describe as the, or Judaism, the bedrock of American politics versus the bedrock of Saudi politics. But what I found interesting is neither sets of people at the top really seem to have all that much regard for the religion or sets of morals that they seem to be adhering to.
Yeah, exactly. The people at the top have been driven by the incentives,
right,
to get there and maintain that.
Yeah.
Which is a total divorce, really, from the principles of Judeo-Christian religions or, yeah, the principles of Islam. On that aesthetic point, something just to cover is the reason this conversation ends up sounding morally confused when it happens in the press is because we're kind of playing the let's judge each other ethically game without ever stopping to establish what we like and what we don't like, what's, mm-hmm, okay and what's not. Mm-hmm. So we end up doing this very human thing, but probably inaccurate thing, of saying, well, that crime over there is bad.
Yeah.
And without quite being able to explain it, apart from just to say, well, hey, it's less aesthetic over there, not talk about our own. That's not to say, oh, two things are bad, end of conversation. But it's to say, if we are going to discuss this ethically, it's not for Newcastle United fans to be in charge of that.
Right.
It's for some kind of centralised conversation.
And to kind of build on the back of that point, do you know what I often think when I end up discussing this, and we often avoided it in doing live shows or in doing any presentation stuff. This is my own platform, so we can do what we want, or our own platform. When you have this conversation, subconsciously, you basically realize that there is actually very little on a personal level that you can do. And that broadly, if you wanted to change it, if I want to change the government or if I want to change the morals of a country, that's actually like a very, not to quote Barack Obama, the arch of justice or the arch of history is long and it bends towards justice or whatever. I think that's the quote, right? But it's an arch. It's not like a 90-degree right angle. And there are a couple of times in history, maybe when it arches more, like you can imagine women's rights, you can imagine equality racially, all these kind of things. But very rarely does it kind of take a complete, not a 180, because it doesn't need to do a 180, but a 45-degree turn, should we say. And there is kind of an existential dread that I'm left with after I do this. And there's a really great documentary maker, I don't know how much you've seen him, Adam Curtis on the BBC, who basically does headmasters talks over great PowerPoint presentations. And one of the documentaries that he makes is called Hypernormalization. If you're interested in why Saudi Arabia, why anyone in the Middle East would be interested in American and Western values and politics, take a look at that. Genuinely left me kind of with a very existential dread for about a week afterwards. So prepare yourself.
The other, not to add to the existential dread, but the goalposts move over time. So history, right, is a long arc, but it's an arc that every 10 years changes a little bit. Mm-hmm. So where you're aiming changes, which is why when you have conversations about huge regions of the world with totally morally different systems in theory, reconciling, it's not even obvious what we mean by reconcile.
Right.
Because we certainly don't think today what we thought 20 years ago. Mm. And you can assume the same in the Middle East, which leaves us with this question of, well, how do we engage with each other?
And also like the local versus the global, all these kind of things, the kind of Marshall McLuhan nature of the whole thing, where it's like, you know, there was a guy back in the 60s called Marshall McLuhan, massive social theorist, the right wing kind of co-opted some of his views and used them, but broadly he wasn't really political. Got some fantastic books, and I've spoken about him a lot. But what he said, he kind of predicted the internet. He said, like, I think in the end, all these things will be networked and we'll bring them all together and you'll see that. What I thought was really interesting about what he said was, I don't predict that we'll like it. And I think that's like a huge part of this. And so we're kind of coming all the way back around to football. Like, it's really great when your team is first bought because the anticipation, the idea of all these things is awesome, right? And that's what I'm kind of getting at here is like the existential dread under all of that. The part of the reason why the Saudis are doing this is because similar to when Madonna found Kabbalah, when she wore the little beads on her wrist why Tom Cruise is a Scientologist, why all of these people are buying into what I would regard as funky spirituality or funky spiritualism in some sense.
Yeah, some edgy, some slightly provocative.
Like a pseudo-religion.
Like a departure from Judeo-Christian standard issue values.
Which, to an extent, is maybe something that we need to have a commentary on, where it is like, hey, should we reassess our Judeo-Christian values here and just, you know, look at how they're relevant to the modern day? Not saying get rid of them, but not ignore some of the factors, should we say?
Well, it's also interesting because if you look at something like Judeo-Christian culture, mm-hmm. we talk about it in conversation like it's a static thing.
Right.
But of course, it's unrecognizable.
Changed. Absolutely, from 2,000 years ago.
And if you look at how it's changed, it's undoubtedly people doing slightly funky things
yeah.
and that being incorporated.
Yeah, right.
It's a little bit like how language changes.
Mm-hmm.
Slang becomes incorporated
right.
and then it stops becoming slang.
Right.
And if you went all English literature A-level on people's day-to-day speech, language wouldn't change.
Yeah.
So when we talk about slightly funky, and I think that's a great term, spirituality.
Funky. You know exactly what I mean.
It's slightly less funky as soon as you zoom out. Because like, oh, hang on, something else was presumed to be just as funky.
Right.
And it's now not.
And it's also like just an overall acknowledgement that, and this is kind of why I spoke about the Hollywood thing at the start. The Saudis are all the way at the top. The government in America all the way at the top. Boris is all the way at the top. All these kind of people. I know Boris isn't prime minister anymore, but he might as well be. So my point is with that, you get to the top and you go, I've got the money, I've got the films, my music is hitting in the charts, the people love me. What's my legacy? Like what on a deep, heartfelt level am I leaving behind? And I think that's where a lot of people hit religion. Or I'm not, and I mean this in the most respectful sense. I'm not saying that people go, oh, I need to leave a legacy, so I'll just become a Christian. Like I'm talking on like a deeper level than that, like a need on these people's behalf to feel something beyond just the forced acknowledgement that is you're number one in the charts or your film's really good or you've got the most money. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and this is the hero's journey. Like sure. You get the thing you want and then realize the thing you actually want was there the whole time. So
right.
Like Jim Carrey will say, I wish everyone could become rich and famous and have yeah. everything they want so that they know it's not enough.
Yeah.
So what they really had was easier to get or more local.
Yeah.
And I agree. So if you zoom out and have that same principle, but you talk about these countries with huge power, it's inevitable. You end up doing things. And in the 1700s, this was physically going abroad to take new land, expansion. Now we're looking at sport as a medium for expansion
right.
and cultural impact and cultural fingerprints everywhere. And they're not like Spaniards on boats going to South America, but it might be golf tournaments right. with new branding.
And what is sport on like a level, on a breakdown? It's a physical expression of, a lot of people see it as a physical expression of life. A lot of people see it as a physical manifestation of many of the things that you feel represent your values. So you'll feel very often you'll feel very close to the club if you, and that club will have an influence on your own personal identity.
Show me how you play and I'll tell you who you are.
Right, yeah. In an almost Cruyffian like kind of way. And there is this and I think that's we can get into that in a little while, but like that is where I think like sport is like a commonly acknowledged, I don't want to call it currency, I would say language, but both. Like it's commonly, so what I'm really saying is it's a commonly acknowledged cultural touch point, right?
It's one of the four or five main expressions of the human form
yeah.
that we all do in some capacity.
And that we can all find some way of fitting in to an extent. Like even if you're not amazing at golf, which I'm not, but I still enjoy playing it and I do quite enjoy watching it.
Yeah, and the reason why things like sport or like music emerge as the cultural pillars that they are is because they're natural. They're emergent from human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, to have your finger on something like sports is, and I think this is where we're going, is strategically a hugely significant play.
Right. And now what we're trying to do, and this is, it's taken us about 15 minutes to get here, but what we're trying to do is work out what this strategy is. Like, I don't want to sit here on this podcast and say, oh, we know what they want. They want power. Like, and maybe broadly they do. But like, I don't want to just sit here and go, they want power and therefore they are bad, because that's just a boring conversation. And it's one that doesn't really lead to any interesting listening.
The other tension about looking at somewhere like Saudi Arabia being expansive and trying to spread a message is that Saudi Arabia are a theocratic state. They're a religious a religious country.
On the surface of it. On the surface of it, they are presented as a religiously governed state.
Right, and they are under no illusions, and they don't want, in the realistic sense of the term, to make the UK run like that. That's not what they're after. So to me, that leaves like, well, we want cooperation, beneficial cooperation. And what are the barriers? What are the bottlenecks to us cooperating with the West? And well, the big one that keeps on coming up when they meet US states or the Boris Johnson is, hey, human rights.
Yeah.
Is, hey, there are some fundamental pieces of how you're running the country, religiously, judicially, that we don't like. So when you say, well, what do they want? Of course we don't know. But they're clearly addressing a bottleneck of image.
And I guess, maybe not to add to that, maybe just to take it slightly left. All right. I guess what they want is also acknowledgement that you can't deny. So for that reason, like, you know, it does shift the conversation to own the football club. Like, if you own something that people love, to an extent, they do have to be nice to you. Like, if, you know, and I don't want to do like the horrible boyfriend analogy, but like, if in years to come, my daughter or son brought home someone that I didn't particularly like, and then they married them, I would feel it to an extent disenfranchised from my relationship with my own child, I guess. Like, I'm not saying this to kind of like, you know, be an overbearing parent, but you know exactly what I mean. Like, your relationship with someone else can be impacted. Maybe it's better to do friends, right? Like, you know, when you have a friend and you both have, I have an acquaintance, but that friend has a friend and they really love that person. You don't really like that person. It's like, when you, there's a weird proxy relationship between all of these things, which gets like worked up. And it's the proxy to Newcastle United, or the proxy to, if they own Liverpool or Manchester United or whoever, that makes me feel off or just weird.
You know, if you have the friend who's got the relationship, which is like an overbearing part of their life, and in your view, not in a good way, mm-hmm. you can feel the distance that puts between you.
Right.
And if you're, I don't know if this is an overly cynical view of Saudi Arabia, but if you can assess like, oh, well, the UK loves their football. Or I mean, like Newcastle United, what a characteristic British football team. If you can have this conversation and feel a little bit weird because now the boyfriend's in the picture, which is the owners, you're kind of disenfranchising the people of Newcastle, right. The British public. And maybe that's an overly cynical view.
I don't know if it's overly cynical. And that's where the PGA thing and the story that's cracked off over the last, I think it's the last few years really, but the last few months in particular, it's really come into sharp focus, is fascinating because it's playing out in practical terms rather than one side or the other really getting what they want. So the PGA Tour is one of the most famous tournaments in the world. It has been competed in and you know, put on some of the best sporting spectacles that we've ever seen. Because golf is hard. Getting a tiny little ball in what is actually a tiny little hole is
500 yards away.
500 yards and, you know, with
a stick.
A stick that you basically have to get a perfect hit on if you want to get it near where you want it to be is hard. And so mastering that, weirdly, to some of the best athletes on the planet, by the way, is alluring. There is something that is almost, I don't want to, and I mean this in the most respectful manner, almost godlike in how you do it. I'm not saying that you are the god, but just to kind of link this to religion, but not to. So years ago, when people used to dance in any Muslim country, when that person was dancing in a particularly, can I say, like, beautiful fashion, and the night was at its absolute most, I don't want to call it tantric because it isn't sexual, but like, yeah, alluring is a great word, right? Everyone in the room is clapping and they would shout, Allah, Allah, Allah. Now, over the years, which obviously just means God in Arabic, I think. So, you know, that can translate to whatever language you want it to be. But to them, obviously, that is a Muslim God, even though it's Abrahamic God. But you get my point.
But
right?
This is interesting, right? Because God's, people will use different language for this.
Yeah.
And the Buddhists won't talk about God, they'll talk about oneness. But the idea that God is in the fullest expression of humans, mm-hmm. in this like slightly alluring moment in the night of dancing, or in peak sporting performance.
Yes, right. And that's kind of where I'm going for here. Right. Over years in Spain, don't know if Spain is a Hispanic country, but you get what I mean, like in countries which spoke Latin languages. Mm-mm-mm. That went from being Allah to being Olé. So when you began to see something brilliant happen on the football pitch, you would see and hear Olé. So you put a ball through someone's legs. What do? You go, Olé, something brilliant has happened. You put a ball, you know, the ball goes in the back of the net. Olé, something brilliant has happened, right? And it's an acknowledgement that in that moment, whether you know it or not, you're acknowledging that God is allowing this, or is doing this thing out on the pitch. And that in itself is like a distillation of life. That's why sport seems so important to me, is like in that moment when Tiger Woods hits that shot and everyone goes, ooh, if it's in an Arabic country, there's possibly like some, you know, then maybe they just feel a little bit more comfortable expressing God, if that makes sense.
But you're right, there is something fundamentally religious about human excellence. Mm-hmm. And when you look at sport, okay, you can be reductionist and say, hey, it's a man hitting a ball into a hole, or there's 22 footballers walking around. And that's one view, but really it's mastery.
Right.
And it gets to something about what makes humans human, which is this desire for expansion, improvement. And when you see something that's clearly refined, it is difficult and it's to not bring in something, and you can call it spiritual or religious or whatever, but there's clearly some feeling that's collective.
Right.
Of like, this is what it means to be a human.
Right.
And that gets expressed through God.
Right. And you know, to some people, maybe, you know, to agnostics or atheists, that's seen as a shorthand for just expression of love of life. To some people who believe in God, that is seen as God and life are two interchangeable ideas. God allows life and vice versa, right?
It's a little bit of a side point, but I've spent a lot of time meditating and being interested in Buddhism. And the language people use mm-hmm. in Buddhist communities when they have a moment, either on the mat meditating or just walking around their life, they'll use the image of God and oneness. And it's the exact same imagery and language that pops up in religions
absolutely.
And cultures globally. That are totally disperse. And, you know, people take psychedelics and they say, hey, man, like, we're all together, we're all one. And that language pops up in, like, Jewish mythology. Mm-hmm. So I don't think sport is at all an ambitious extension of that. And perfection in sport, I mean, if you look at Lionel Messi walking around Buenos Aires, it's not an unreligious scene.
Yeah. And I spent a lot of time in the last week in Naples finishing off like what I would call a documentary, as people would probably call a YouTube video, about Napoli obviously winning the Scudetto. Diego Maradona's face is everywhere. And it's basically him, Jesus, and Mary everywhere. And to be frank, there's more images of Maradona than there are Jesus. And in fact, at the shrine to Maradona, next to the Maradona mural, or Maradona de Murales, or whatever you want to call it, because I don't know how to speak Italian, there is literally at the bottom a picture of Jesus and a picture of Maradona, and in the middle it says, what's the difference?
God, but the thing is, people in Naples are so fucking Christian anyway. Mm. And Maradona, I have to say, is like a saviour figure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. I mean, especially in Naples, he is quite literally a saviour figure. They'd never won Scudetto before he went there. That he completely changed their perception of themselves and their ability to actually win something. And it's also one of the most unlikely things that this man would walk amongst his own people, if that makes sense. Like, how can you take a boy out of South America that is him and take him to a place so far away and there be such a synergy between those two cultures, and at the same time the rest of the world have to acknowledge that? Like, this isn't whilst it is not a religious experience, it is, we'll get back to why this is important around the whole Saudi Arabia conversation in a second, but like, it is important to acknowledge that like these kind of experiences are hard to manufacture. Like, it's not easy to force this stuff. And it's just as easy to have basically fire blanks. Maradona could have gone to another country, could have gone to another place, and we would regard him completely differently. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, and the thing is, uncertainty and jeopardy and the spontaneous nature of sport make these unbelievable human experiences possible.
Right.
It's why I've never gone to the theater or to see a film or even a gig, which is the second closest, and gone, like, celebrated as if I were the goal.
Right.
And to tie that all back in.
You've never been to the theatre or to a cinema and felt like I suppose I've never felt a level of emotion that I felt Anfield. I get that. Like, the very peak. But there are some films where I have sort of gone... Lego movie's pretty good.
The Emoji Movie bangs.
It bangs, yeah. No, but you get what I mean. Like, there are some films where...
But it's an important point, because there's a qualitative difference. And this is why maybe I'm a sports fan more than a film fan.
Right.
But I can be in awe of a film.
Yeah.
Or think, Jesus, this is so good. This is like silencing me. I can't produce that. Like, this is just brilliant human expression.
Right.
But there's a distinction. Because when Alexander Arnold takes a corner quickly and Origi puts it in the top corner, if I'm speaking Lawrence here.
Which you are.
Which I am. There's no, in my view, comparison in other art forms. Now, like, you can take this too far. Gary Neville said, well, you know, everyone's got kids. I had two daughters, but the Premier League or the Champions League, that was the best day of my life. Sure. Yeah, okay. So that I view as like a extension for humor. But he is getting at the principle which lives there, which is spontaneity and uncertainty.
It takes a moment of spontaneity and uncertainty to create kids.
Yeah, but if you run the experiment enough.
Yeah, if you run the experiment enough, then you're too spontaneous and you're too uncertain, and that's part of the problem, right? Yeah. I get what you're saying, though. So you're sort of pointing in the right... Yeah, I think you're pointing broadly in the same direction as I am, is that right?
Yeah, and I think the point fundamentally is, like, it shows why, in a long kind of way, why it's so important, sporting institutions.
Right.
And why the relationships between people and their sports clubs, or a golf fan and the PGA, matter.
Right. So this is where... So the Naples story comes back to people are proud of... and the video will be out at some point within the next couple of weeks. I've got a few other things I need to tick off on my to-do list first. But what I felt in that moment was the people of Naples were proud of two things. They were proud of Maradona, and there was a chant that literally just says, I saw Maradona, I saw Maradona. And I love it. Like, it's so catchy. We were walking around and we were singing it the whole time. And, you know, it's kind of easy to get into. But what was interesting about that was there were tattoos of this guy on everyone. There were tattoos of Napoli on everyone. And those two things were seen as interchangeable. The institution of Napoli and the institution of Maradona were both something that people wanted to point their gratitude towards. And that was because those people, and Maradona in particular, had found, here's what I'm going for, a repeatable formula and structure within which they could make the morals of Naples and the values that those people held dear, and I'm not going to take credit for that. That was Neil from the Anvil rap. I don't remember his second name at this point. Who said the same thing about Liverpool? Like, if you know, these clubs represent our values, or we feel that way, right? And therefore, these repeatable pieces of success feel like an extension of those values and those kind of things, right?
Shit. But the interesting thing there is, let's say City go win the European Cup then five times in the next 10 years, and the people of Manchester feel as connected with Abu Dhabi as perhaps the people of Naples did with Maradona, as that seems a little bit unlikely.
Sure.
But again, it shows, like, Jesus, you can hijack this religious fervor.
But I don't know if you can. And that's kind of, I don't know if in 45 minutes or however long we're going to get to the bottom of that. But I think I kind of want to point in the right direction at the end of it. I'm not sure what the right direction is. Geography has something to do with this, though. And I'm not sure if you can shortcut geography. And I'm also not sure if you can... So in the same way as if you join Scientology or Kabbalah or whatever it is, I'm not sure you can shortcut that. Like, you know, you can't become a black belt in judo overnight. You can't become a black belt in... I don't even know if you can get a black belt in BJJ. But you get what I mean. Like, you can't... You've got to do the belts. You've got to do the dance.
Well, and as significantly, it's very hard to fall in love with an owner. I mean, like, Leicester fans loved their owner who passed away. They preferred Jamie Vardy.
Right.
So...
Do they?
I'd say so.
Maybe not now, but at the time they did. I think now maybe his legacy has slightly been soiled by the fact that he has also disrespected the institution of football with everything that happened with his wife. But apart from that, I get what you're saying.
Possibly, but basically, like, you know, historians, there are historians who will say, look, you can explain history through systems, the development of systems. And there's other historians who will interpret the same events and say, no, it wasn't that English cricket became egalitarian. It's that Freddie Flintoff was awesome.
Sure.
And most people live in that second camp. When we're trying to connect emotionally
with
things.
True? Yeah. Yeah. Well, but I mean, is it actually true?
Is it true that most people connect?
Is it not that, or not, is it true that most people actually connect that way, but just because you connect that way, does that make it true?
No.
Like, I can fudge a printer to print from my laptop, but that's not the way that Apple will recommend me to do it, if that makes sense.
My sense is the history is basically explained in institutions and systems. There's this book, Why Nations Fail, which super convincingly says, hey, if you want to explain the success of countries, look at property rights and look at institutions. Mm-hmm. And I basically buy that as a general arc of history.
Okay.
I don't think though, and this is a difficult piece of news for the Saudis, I don't think you can connect emotionally that way. It might be a brilliant explanation of history, but I don't think it forms emotional connections.
Right, and that feeds perfectly into the point that I'm kind of getting to, which has taken us about 30 minutes. But I think it's okay, because the PGA Tour is trusted, or was trusted, because it had found a way to consistently recreate a scenario where we could heighten our sense of enjoyment around sport. That is what all the good sporting institutions, what NFL do. I know there are huge problems. A lot of people have huge problems with some of the practices of NFL. Some people have a lot of problems with the way the NBA have practiced in the past, and I know people are trying to change that. Some people have huge problems with the Premier League, right? Because morally, I'm sure there is plenty of things wrong. And the PGA, I'm sure, also has its own moral problems.
But nonetheless,
they found a repeatable formula to heighten our sense of sport and to heighten our sense of, in that moment, wow, what has Tiger Woods just done? Wow, what has Phil Mickelson just done? Wow, what has Rory McIlroy just done? And it was so big and so repeatable that people sponsored it, and then it went from there, right? Now, that might have been the goal, and they might have been cynically trying to make a business out of it. But the point is that, yeah, like, it's a big American institution. The first person to do it kind of wins. That's the way it works, right? And Saudi kind of wanted in on that. The TV rights, all these things were huge. Like, people sat there and went, I love watching golf clips when in the golf clip the commentator isn't close to the place where the putt is, but he's like, he's over the ninth hole now, and we see him lower his head. I can't do it because what they do is masterful.
But it's, you know something, when you frame it like that, it's really easy to get into 2023 with $500 billion in PIF money.
Yeah.
It's really hard to set up the FA.
Yeah.
So they're actually looking at this and going, Jesus, we don't have to do any of the setup. We just buy the rights and then we're in.
But what they kind of did was they sort of bought the players, and it's easier to buy. So it's easier to buy the individuals than it is to buy an institution. Right? So they couldn't buy the PGA, although we will talk about that in a second. But what they could do with the people who led it was basically get the players to agree to change the way that they would earn money. So they could be paid like basically a fat sum of money up front, which then I think some guys agreed if they won, they wouldn't get a prize because it would be taken out of the money they got up top. And then other people, it would kind of be like a golden set of handcuffs where down the years you retain more and more and more money, right? So if you can stay on the LIV tour, as they called it, everyone's obsessed with three letters, you know, PIF, LIV, PGA, you'd get more money. You'd basically get a wage and your family would be all right.
It's a bit like Achilles with his heel, right?
Right.
If the golf institutions are Achilles.
Yeah.
Well, the players are the heel. Like, if you get all the top players, mm-hmm. well, you don't have Achilles anymore.
Yeah, that's good.
And the way the Saudis have done it is, until, Jesus, like 48 hours ago, as we record,
yeah,
is to have a go at that Achilles.
Wow.
But now it seems, Lawrence, that they've taken a different approach and they're going for Achilles himself.
Right. Which within itself is pretty fascinating, right? And like they completely broke the structure of golf. They basically went in and went, listen, we don't think this works for the players. And I think it was Phil Mickelson, I think it was, who basically said, I'll find a way to guide everyone out of this. Yeah, like Mickelson told a journalist that despite Saudi Arabians being, and I'll quote them, I'll quote him here, scary motherfuckers who'd, as it says here, murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi and executed, as it says here on Wikipedia, gay people. He supported the Saudi-backed LIV Golf because it offered an opportunity to reshape the PGA Tour.
There's a lot there.
That's a long sentence, but it is.
There's a lot there, though, because
he lost sponsors, by the way, because of that. And he announced he'd be stepping away from golf to spend time with his family. And would miss the Masters.
He was offered an LIV contract?
Yeah.
Did he take it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, he did. On the first day of LIV, the PGA suspended Mickelson and 16 other current and former members. Yeah. So there you go.
Okay, so he's thought, basically, I'm going to take the money from them and piss off the PGA.
I mean, a lot of people thought that.
And then he's going to then piss off his current employers, you'd assume.
So here's where it gets interesting, right? So the players are basically split. It doesn't really matter who went where, right? Some big names went with LIV and some big names stayed with the PGA. And Tiger Woods was apparently offered $750 million, which is a huge amount of cash, which, by the way, he turned down, which is pretty mad and speaks to my Kabbalah type idea here of like, there is a bigger thing at play.
How much cash do you need to have to turn down $750 million?
They call it fuck you money. And I think Tiger Woods probably has that.
Well, he's had that for a decade. I mean,
he's got fuck anyone money, right? I mean, that's quite literally
he's got Obama's personal number, I reckon. It's that kind of fuck you money.
Right, sure. Yeah. And I don't think that's not really all that exclusive anymore, but I get your point. So lots of people turned it down. Lots of people stayed with the PGA. And the PGA very much encouraged players to not publicly deride the whole thing, but to be vocal about what was going on, right? And probably rightly so. Like, if you're going to pick a side on this, pick a side. You're in with them.
Especially if you're with what you consider to be the good guys. Like, you know, one of the benefits of being with the good guys is you can shout about it.
Right. Yeah, right. And that was also a huge part of it, right? But who's the good guys in this? Because the LIV Golf guys see themselves as the good guys, and the PGA see themselves as the good guys, because both of where they're coming from represent outcomes which benefit that geographic area of the world.
What's LIV's argument that they're the good guys?
LIV's argument would be, in this case, the players were not happy for years with the payment structure and how people earned money. We paid people a fat check based on the money that we already have, and we've completely broken and changed the structure of everything that happened.
Were the players unhappy, or were they just unhappy relative to $500 million up front?
I think they were. I think if you're on the PGA Tour, you're probably a super happy person anyway. You're a golfer, right? Your back might hurt a little bit and maybe you're worried about your swing. But broadly, to be a golfer in life is a quite privileged position, right? There's only about a couple of hundred people that get to do that per year, right? But you can still be unhappy with the situation or unhappy with the thing you have to sort of take part in, if that makes sense. So there's like there's that meme online where the woman has the wood on her back and she's like, oh, it's so hot out here and like, I can't get water from the well. And there's a person behind her kind of pointing at her and going, oh, you criticize the system, yet you partake in it. Right, like, you are the problem.
But were they factually unhappy? Have there been murmurings from the PGA saying, oi, this payment structure doesn't work?
I don't think from the PGA, but I think from the players in general, they were probably, I mean, I suppose if you're shown that the grass is greener, then you'd probably be unhappy with where your grass is, maybe?
Yeah, well, this is interesting, right? Because LIV's argument that they're the good guys for offering fair wages, I mean, fair with an asterisk.
I don't know if they are fair, by the way, but let's just portray it that way for the ease.
If that's their argument, hey, look, we're finally paying people what they are worth, is a stronger argument if people have been for a decade and a half saying, right, oi, pay us more.
So I don't know if they've broadly been saying that. I think a lot of people were kind of happy with it. They were happy with the PGA product. Like, go and watch some golf highlights. It looks great. Like, the cameras are fantastic. The camera work is incredible. All the courses look awesome. Golf is an incredibly wealthy sport anyway, that's, you know, mostly consumed, I'd assume, by older people, but has a very much an interest from younger people because, you know, they want to be part of that hierarchy and that structure.
It's just interesting, right? Because one of the things that the LIV Tour could have done is not get into the argument of good and bad. And I don't know to what degree they have.
And I don't, to be honest, I don't think they have.
Yeah.
But I think that maybe it was kind of portrayed that way because it's a shorthand for everything else, right?
And also, if you're being accused of being the bad guys, right, any response you have necessarily has to include, no, we're the good guys.
Right.
Saying you're the bad guys and responding, oh no, we're very efficient, doesn't seem to be a good response.
And I get that. And I think broadly, like, that's part of why sports washing kind of gets leveled, I guess, at these guys. This is because sometimes there is too much assumption or too many hoops you have to jump through to get to their conclusions. And maybe it's also perspective is what I'm kind of going for here, is like, your perspective on Saudi Arabia would be very different to a Saudi Arabian's perspective on Saudi Arabia, possibly because we're both subject to propaganda.
What have you made of Rory?
McIlroy. Yeah. I mean, he was very openly denouncing the LIV Tour, wasn't he? I don't think he liked the format, but I think that's an aesthetic difference.
I thought it was quite cool. Like, without getting into the specifics of rights and wrongs, I think it was quite cool. He was like, well, fuck you guys.
Right.
This is cool. This is wrong. it's kind of refreshing because the top sportsmen are much more media trained than that.
Yeah, and maybe, again, because he's an individual and partially, possibly because he knew he could do that because the PGA Tour backed him and he was like so, he was so prominent in it.
And he's not worried about his team losing sponsors.
What?
You know, he can make the assessment, am I going to lose sponsorship? Yeah or no. Do I care? Yeah or no.
Sure.
Whereas if you're Jordan Henderson or Mesut Ozil.
So Ozil's a fascinating conversation to have here. Yeah. Mesut Ozil on a number of levels is... I've kind of had this conversation before, and I think it totally depends on how you think political influence is exerted, shall we say, on where you think, whether you think Mesut Ozil is a good guy, a bad guy, or someone who is somewhere in between. And maybe that's not the conversation we have right now,
But the point is, when he criticized China, mm-hmm. I think Arsenal lost sponsorship.
Yeah, because that's kind of the nature of sponsorship from places like China, right? Like it comes with a caveat. Like,
and if you lost a personal sponsorship, that's one thing. But just, I guess the point is, if you're involved in a team sport, you're not just fucking up your own sponsorship.
Right.
You're messing up your teams as well.
But, and I guess from my perspective, I totally get what you're saying. And I think I made this argument quite a lot to a number of people. But when you feel that people are dying or you feel that people are subject to subjugation that you just cannot stomach, your employer's losing a brand deal or your employer's losing money possibly doesn't feel as important to you if you feel an affiliation with the people who are being hurt, right? But the problem being, that's kind of how that's kind of how the powers that be have set that up, so that there is this back door through which you can hurt your own people, and that, and therefore you will be subject to anger. You'll be like people when, say, Dustin Johnson, Sergio Garcia, you know, I think it was Brooks Koepka left as well. Lee Westwood, like a massive name in golf, in at least in the UK. One source said Johnson, winner of two major championships and a former world number one, was paid $150 million to play in the LIV series. Johnson, who had won 24 PGA events and $74 million since 2008, announced his resignation and said this, "I choose what's best for me and my family." And that was his justification. And this is kind of why I'm going back to geography here. Like, if it's the end of his garden that he cares about and that's all that he cares about, then sure, he's secured generational wealth for forever, right? But we go back to the Madonna and Tom Cruise and all these people, it goes beyond that for me. You can't just shortcut it and go, cool, I've got the cash.
Yeah, well, Peter Singer, this Australian philosopher, makes this point the whole time. Geography is not a relevant moral variable.
A relative?
Relevant.
Oh, relevant, wow.
Yeah, so he says, look, okay, if you walked down the street and saw a 10-year-old drowning, and you could ruin your shoes to save him, and you didn't save him, you'd be a monster.
Right.
But the fact that you could create the same outcome, save someone's life, for the same amount of money as replacing your shoes in Libya, and you don't, feels different.
Right.
And it feels different because it's far away.
Yeah.
But like, he argues, why the hell is that relevant? It's far away. And I think there's two answers here. One is like an evolutionary psychology thing. Mm-hmm. We weren't built to care about stuff not in our 6 inches in front of our face. But like his argument here, you'd have a grumpy Australian philosopher saying, it doesn't matter that
your family benefit.
Your family benefit in the US, because I tell you something, if the crimes Saudi Arabia are accused of were happening at the end of his street, he wouldn't touch the cash.
Right. Or he couldn't touch the cash, just out of sheer rejection of the community. And that'd be part of the issue, right? Is like, to an extent, we can't see it, we can't hear it. And therefore, hear no evil, see no evil.
Yeah, and I kind of accept you have to operate like that. It's impossible to walk around as a human being with an equal attention on moral crimes as on the other side of the world as you do locally. There's something functionally that doesn't work about that.
Right.
But that argument that he's making there is very intuitive. I don't judge him for it. But like, it takes about 5 seconds to wilter under the light.
Sure. But we're kind of getting onto this moral argument, which is what keeps sidetracking the sporting argument, right? And there are some very compelling journalists out there making very compelling moral arguments. But what I'm saying here is, let's talk strategy of what Saudi Arabia or PIF or whatever you want to call it, the LIV Tour, was doing, right? They undermined the structure of the PGA, which is a prominent American institution in the first place. And they did that quite successfully for relatively little investment on their behalf, right? Like, under a billion.
A billion is nothing.
A billion is a throwaway to those guys, right? Like, I think it's very easy to generate that, and they have trillions.
So to have the strategic impact you're talking about
is massive, right? For a thousandth of your wealth, or 100,000th, or whatever you want to call it, right? That's huge. And they kind of bought their way into that. But what a lot of people underestimate, at least from my perspective, is, again, the legacy of these things. So it was not just that it was people hitting a ball. They bought the people that hit the balls, right? And this is where I question their strategy. Why spend all the money on Ronaldo? And, you know, they offered Messi $1 billion and all the golfers. And they could do the same if they wanted tomorrow with the tennis, right? They could just buy all the individuals in the tennis or any of the other sports. If then the way you're going to promote it and package it is so bad and poorly thought through strategically, but also executionally, that you don't benefit from that. Like, it stinks of going to the Gucci store, buying your Gucci belt, and putting it on a pair of jeans that it just doesn't suit, right? And that's kind of my point here, is like, if you can spend the 100 million on one player, you're not going to get a good photographer for this? Like, maybe that's beyond, I don't even think it's beyond, I actually think for me that's really key. Like, I've had some friends who worked in Saudi Arabia, and they've made beautiful videos there, they've taken beautiful photos, they've done all these things. No one's seen them. Like, I should be number one market for this stuff. I've not seen a Ronaldo goal in Saudi Arabia. I don't know. Now, maybe I'm not. Maybe they don't give a damn about me. But I'd imagine if you want to convince people, you kind of want to convince us, that makes sense.
This is bizarre. I've actually never thought about this before. Yeah, they've spent all this cash. I genuinely haven't seen, like...
a goal. I've not seen a Ronaldo goal. I've sought one out... but I've never been presented with one.
If you're going to spend $1 billion on Ronaldo, it's worth spending $1 billion on Instagram and TikTok to make sure that everyone who you're buying him to impress can see the thing.
It would be, from my perspective, and maybe I'm thinking of it just from a media wanker's perspective, but like...
I mean, that's possible.
Possibly. From my perspective, it is better to get Steven Spielberg or, you know, Werner Herzog or someone like that, like a prominent American director or a German in this sense. And I think he's Austrian, Werner Herzog, maybe he's German, might be offending him. And say to them, come in and tell us, how do we shoot this sporting thing differently? We're going to build football broadcasts from the ground up and get rid of any of the preconceptions that people have that the main camera needs to go on the halfway line, or that we can shoot this on this lens or that, whatever it is.
Let's be genuinely innovative.
I'm going to give you, Steven Spielberg, $1 billion.
To make this work unbelievably well.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
You can build a stadium of your own in which we will shoot the best sporting spectacle we've ever seen. We're not going to build something that wows the West. We're not going to build something that wows our own people. We're going to build something from the ground up that we're going to engage the people who make the cameras. We're going to engage the people who grow the grass. We're going to do all this stuff. We've given you a lab and $1 billion. Make this from the ground up. But instead, then that's when you get Ronaldo. Mm-mm-mm. You don't get Ronaldo now and get him to play in the league that no one cares about. And I get it. Like, people in Saudi Arabia care about the league. It seems like a very well-populated league. I'm sure locally it's fantastic. And that's not what I'm critiquing here. What you're doing is you're putting the dog before the cart before the horse, all these kind of things.
There's no TV deal. You can't watch him right in the UK. That's a bizarre miss.
But then come to Sky and say, you don't pay us, we'll pay you. We will pay you to put Saudi Arabian football on here. And not only that, you can put whatever advertising you want next to it so you can make even more money next to it.
And we want Micah Richards.
Yeah.
And we want Gary Neville.
Micah, we'll give you $10 million a year. Yes, I'll do it straight away.
This is a really good point, and it's not one I've heard made before.
Right.
The actual product
is terrible.
So the other side of this, though, is they might just say, well, screw that. Ronaldo is the most followed person on Instagram. Mm-hmm. He's doing the legwork. I'm not sure it's a good argument, but I can see it being made, right?
So, and that's what I kind of get here. And again, this is where I get into culture clash, right? So, and you know, I've never been to the Middle East, so I cannot judge those people. I cannot, and I'm never in any fashion am I judging local people who are on the ground. I'm judging the strategy that I see of the government who are trying to market football globally, right? And I feel like I have a fairly good read on that. I'm not amazing, but a fairly good read. My point here is, why are you marketing it so badly? And it was a huge, it was huge. Optics and the appearance of what was going on between LIV and PGA played a huge role, as far as I'm concerned, in the way that this all played out. Because obviously a lot of things went to court because there were contracts and things that were broken and all these kind of things. And in court, the optics that played out were even worse because there were terrible emails from the Saudi government at the very, very, very top level. Not like obviously between the Saudi, but you know, very, very top level of people who are planning it badly and saying terrible things and all these kind of things, right? And it was just completely undermining the imagery that they wanted. The optics of the scenario were terrible, right? And on top of that, the LIV product was then awful by most people's evaluation. I'm not having to go at other media professionals here. I'm not saying the grade was off, but what I'm saying is the product in comparison to the PGA was poor because. Not only that, but how can I put it? Okay, when we first got the TV in the 60s, right? No one knew what TV was going to do to the world, but what they did do was go: is it better than the radio? Yeah, it's better than the radio. Okay, what does the radio do? All right, you tune the radio, and then you get the audio. So the same must happen with the TV. And you tuned your TV and you got your audio and your visual. So they kind of just added a bit to radio, if that made sense. And really most of the shows back in the 60s or like when TV became very commercially viable, which was probably in the 60s and maybe a bit in the 50s. And I get that people had TVs during and before that. But, you know, we're talking about when it became accessible to everyone and was in everyone's homes. I'm talking about color TV, really. They basically went, okay, everyone can now tune into this, and the language that people and the way that people perceived TV was based on the previous medium that they'd seen. So the LIV tour was always going to be judged on the standards of the PGA tour and the medium of the PGA tour that we'd seen, the white middle class to upper class man's idea of what sport and sports broadcast is, which is ESPN, which is Sky, which is all the things, right?
It's weird to mess that up, though, because you have such a clear reference point.
And I get that, but that's the other aspect of this, right? So if you haven't got people who are trained in what is a fine art, it's very hard to put that on.
But they're cheap compared to the players, which is why your point is good.
My point.
Yeah.
Right? Why is it that no one from the LIV Tour went... And again, it comes down to, I don't think these people know... I don't think they had a strategy. I don't think they thought through what was...
But then Saudi Arabia and Newcastle United looked terribly thought through.
Did it?
Well, it does now.
Right.
You know, they've got the right manager. They haven't splashed the cash in the way that Bowley does at Chelsea.
Go on.
And it's just strange that it's being run by the same people. Because it is being run by the same institution, at least.
And do you think that that's partially, again, because of Newcastle, they've been a little bit more... careful, I want to say. Like, there's also kind of like pre-existing rules that they're on a break. Amanda Staveley seems fairly sort of central cog to that kind of thing.
And Newcastle's quite respectful,
right,
as far as a takeover goes. Like, they're not wanting to rock the boat of the institution of the Premier League.
Do you think, but that was partially, and this is where the LIV and the PGA, we come back to the LIV and the PGA thing. The government kind of, and 50% stepped in and 50% didn't. They were kind of like, oh, it's just the Premier League's a responsibility and we trust them. You're like, sorry, what? Like, it's not something to do with you. This is a government that is buying a sporting club.
It's a good point. The government's response was a bit like...
pithy.
Well, yeah. You guys do it.
Go on, do what you need. And the kind of the same has happened. And so the LIV Tour were pissing off the PGA, but... also in America and where most people were consuming the golfing product, people were laughing at the LIV Tour because the LIV Tour changed the format. There were other ways that you would play a round of golf, all these kind of things. Points would have to add up in a certain way, all these kind of things. It was relatively compelling, but the players didn't really like it, right? Well, the players liked it, but they liked it because they were getting the money. So then, what next? So the PGA Tour is annoyed. Everyone's in court. It's coming out left, right, and center that everything has been poorly run and that really the PGA Tour is... pretty good, but the Saudis are getting humiliated in court, which obviously they don't want because honor and respect is a huge part of royal governance.
And the mission, by the way, of buying the thing in the first place.
Because of optics and because of, I guess, being intertwined with those areas, right? And then it got super serious because the PGA Tour and everyone else went to the American government, Congress, and was saying to congressmen as soon as a month ago, these people pose not only an existential threat to our country, and by the way, America loves sports, so it is an existential threat to their sporting love. But a moral and a realistic political threat. And then a month later, or 2 months, so this negotiation has been going on for a while, but 2 months where it's been really intense, a deal signed. And all the people on the PGA Tour who went to bat for the PGA, who didn't take the live money, are shocked. They hear it in the same way as we do. They hear it on ESPN or on wherever it is. What? Like, that's insane to me that you kept these people on your tour of the PGA and said to them, we're going to fight this. Like, these people are softly involved with things that we disagree with. I think the people around this is even engaged, like families of 9/11 and things like that, that they were kind of like softly kind of alluding to the fact that they thought the Saudis were involved in it, blah, blah, blah. Whether you do or not is another thing, but they were using that. Like, so this is deep, right?
You're going hard there though. If you're referencing the imagery of 9/11,
which you are, right? And I'm not saying I fall in one camp or the other. I'm not saying who was,
but that's what they were doing.
Yeah. That's pretty heavy stuff to put on a goal, a guy who basically hits a ball with a stick.
Especially because, like, they were so secretive, which is a worse look. It's like, you know, when you're a bit younger and you get caught doing something bad, mm-hmm. and you're actually caught, like, putting your phone in your pocket or putting a note away. And the fact that you look so guilty about it doesn't help your case.
Right.
It's the same here.
Exactly the same. And so they announce it. And I remember at the time being like, wow, this is seismic. Like, the PGA and the LIV Tour, which were the American institution, the Saudi institution, although not really Saudi, it's PIF, but Saudi, are merging. And on the board, the PGA had more control. So there were three seats for the PGA. There was one tour for LIV, one seat for LIV. So in time, it seems as if LIV would basically get swallowed up by the PGA. But the Saudis would be on the inside. They'd be in the boardroom with everyone else.
How do you think Joe Biden feels about this?
I think Joe Biden's got other issues right now. But I also think, and I don't mean that in like his normal manner. I mean, like, he's got wars to literally probably, you know, democratize around.
But let's say he has an opinion and he's interested in defending American values. Mm-hmm. Where does he land on this?
I don't know. That's kind of my point, is like, I don't know where Americans and how America feels about the values of the Middle East. I think the Americans now, and Joe Biden in particular, will know he was part of a previous government, which obviously represented hope to so many people in Barack Obama, but also dropped a lot of bombs on a lot of people and like was a cover for a lot of terrible things that happened in that period. So I can't imagine he feels incredible about it.
It's funny, right? Because like on the left in the West, we're quite anti the West in general. We're quite critical of the West. The one thing that gets the West more defensive about itself is, oh yeah, the Middle East's deciding to stamp it. Well, now all of a sudden the British flags are out.
They'll metaphorically. Yeah, metaphorically. And they'll go to bat for these people. But that's what happened with LIV, and that's what happened with the Gulf, was these players went out to bat for what is essentially what they consider to be Western values. And the next day, when the money worked, the PGA went, yep, cool, we'll change that now. We get the money at the top. And the really prominent players who stay with the PGA, potentially they don't get anything. They still get nothing from this. So they've gone to bat for you, they've made nothing out of it, nothing more. And now all their colleagues are coming back into the same tour. There is talk about them being like fined and these kind of things, or maybe like some of the money will be given back.
But it's small change.
They've still not made 20, you know, whoever's involved in the LIV Tour has still made a lot of money.
It's interesting though, because when we're talking about it in these terms, maybe LIV were like, Jesus, we don't want to have such an adversary relationship. Like in the long run, if we're going to do this sport expansion thing, let's play nice with the Americans.
Right. And this is kind of what I wonder, whether LIV had this as a long-term goal or not, I'm kind of wondering. Like whether they thought, we're going to get a seat at the table, we might have to go the long way around and buy a slice of the cake and then put it back into the cake.
Have the leverage initially to at least have the conversation.
Right. You need the leverage, but they have no leverage. So they have to buy leverage in the conversation.
Well, it's a little bit like if you have a house party and you know it's too loud, but you think, hey, we might get away with this.
Right.
But our fallback position is we'll just go to the silent disco. It might be that they thought, well, fuck, we could have the whole thing.
Right.
You know, like my mate DJ's and he's awesome and I promised him he could.
Yeah.
But now the headphones have come on.
Right. And to an extent, like you're almost forcing the neighbors to take part in your party. So with that, they now have a slice of the cake, but they've undermined themselves. Both sides have kind of undermined themselves. And there's a possibility this still doesn't even go through because the actual people that were both negotiating and slagging the other side off have gone to opposition. Like, they've basically gone to the government and gone, those guys are terrible. And then 20 minutes later gone, maybe they're not as bad as we said. I don't... Do you know what I mean?
Do you think the government are going to turn around and say...
I think they might block it.
And say, hang on, but can you explain to me why those arguments no longer apply?
Yeah.
Because that was a 9/11 family.
I get it.
That made quite an emotional speech. Remind me why that's not relevant anymore?
You tell me.
You know, like, that's...
Tell me, why?
Look, you can always argue these things two ways, and they're just PR teams pulling their hairs out, right? Like, right now, you have a PR team reading through the transcript of some emotional interview, going, oh, shit, this is worse than we remember.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And we get back to where I kind of was. I wanted this to be 45 minutes, become an hour. I think I monologued. What I'm saying is, and a lot of people's conclusion at the moment is this, what's to stop them from doing this with any sport? You know, hey, Malcolm was saying, what is to stop them from doing that with any of our other institutions? They could do it with the sailing. We love doing the sailing on the weekends. What if they come and take our sailing? Is everyone at the sailing club going to be called Mohammed from now on, are they? Like, it's that kind of approach of like, you know, I get that I know nothing about this from the outside, but I guess I'm kind of interested in actually theorizing about it and not damning these people. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's funny because if you ever watch Dragon's Den, the question every startup get is, why couldn't Amazon just do this?
Right.
And the only good response is, well, look, everyone's worried about that. It's an existential threat. Shrug. Right. There's no real response you can make. And the same applies to the sailing. If the Saudis want to get involved in the sailing, if Amazon want to get involved in the bike sharing business, they can.
And I guess to an extent, like, I've watched in researching this, and I've probably got a lot of things wrong in the way that I've detailed the situation, because I haven't really, you know, I've only really brought myself up to speed up the last few days. I've seen, like, quite a few conferences recently of kind of Middle Eastern countries, you know, the kind of, you know, let's all get into a room and think about this. And it's like a massive room of like 500 people, and there's three men sitting on stage, and... You know, one of them's a prince, one of them's a, you know, whatever high-ranking person in that area they are. And the overall message was like, at one point, Europe was the center of the world, which is probably fair enough, you know, historically, even if, you know, you've never been. Now we want to be that. We want to be the economic power that throws its weight around. And part of that is owning the culture. And that, I think... As you know, as democratic, that's not democratic. Like, that's a little bit scary, if that makes sense. That it's not even that it's like someone who I don't know and it's like a foreign person. It's that these people are billionaires in the same way as our billionaires are, you know, not very good at doing sport. Like, you know, Todd Bowley's not great at doing sport.
Yeah, but and the other scary thing about it is our institutions are incentivized to play ball.
Yes, because they're intertwined, and the governments are, you know, the governments are basically bedfellows. And what else around that, you know?
And picking a fight about the Gulf, if you're trying to get information about ISIS, seems like a really stupid use of time.
Correct.
So there's the government's regulation side, which feels weak, but then the institutions themselves think, I mean, look at the PGA. Yeah, we'll have some cash.
Yeah.
So,
but they've literally taken the cash. So this is part of it, right? Is the Saudis, or I don't want to keep saying the Saudis, but anyone who's come along to invest with a huge amount of cash has basically come along and gone, take the cash, don't worry about why. And they've gone, brilliant, we'll do it.
Yeah, because this is the structural problem. The institutions aren't like these collective unionized things where it's like very hard for the Saudis to crack. Because, you know, these aren't willing institutions to play ball. No. These institutions were set up on the principle of playing ball with this kind of thing.
Right.
And the reason why they've traditionally been the powers is because of that system.
Right.
You know, it's funny, like, it's a silly analogy in some ways, but Uber don't make a profit on the basis that they lobbied against regulation to make it very easy for them to come in. But now any dickhead with a VC billion can do the same thing in their area.
Correct.
The same is true here. If you're going to set up an institution that's profit generating and all about that, someone else with a billion quid who fancies a piece of the cultural pie can come in.
And the same goes for Netflix, and the same goes for all these people. Like at the moment, and this is what I'm kind of worried about, is like there is another whole conversation we can have on this podcast about the product of sport and how football is presented, right? Am I happy with it? Not particularly. Like, do I dislike the football I watch? No, like I enjoy it. Do I think it could be better? Yeah. Like, would I love to watch it on an app on my phone or on an iPad? Yeah, I'd quite like to. You know, would I like it to work like the NBA app? Probably. Like, would I like it to work like the NFL app? Probably. Would I like to have to pay less for it? Yeah, I pay fucking like £100 a month right now to be able to watch the maximum amount of sport legally in my own country. That's insane to me.
Well, especially because if you're going to watch any football in this country, you're inevitably doing it illegally.
Yes.
To some degree.
And to an extent, like, you know, you're kind of forcing my hand because you're not showing me the sport, if that makes sense. But that's what I'm saying here is like, is it poorly packaged? Yes. So the Netflixization of this stuff and therefore, like, I guess the productization of everything that's going on, part of the future of sport may be around like the product that these big countries present. Like, you know, it will be PGA versus LIV. It will be Barclays Premier League, or not Barclays, but like, you know, Premier League versus whatever it is that the Saudis or whoever it is that's most rich make. Like, there is a whole other conversation to be had there. But what's interesting about the Netflixization of these kind of things, and what I find interesting right now, is Netflix in Hollywood, or Netflix in the movie industry, is at one point came in and basically went, we'll give your actor 20 million.
Ricky Gervais, 25 mil for a 1 hour stand-up.
Right. Yeah. We have no idea how popular that stand-up was. I mean, we know it was relatively big, right? I was a massive Ricky Gervais fan. Like, for Animals and Politics, his first two stand-ups, huge. Like, must have watched them 100 times. I didn't even bother with the last one. But that's pretty fucking interesting, right? Like, but Netflix can push it in your face. They can put it at the top of there. They can take it at the top of the page. You might watch it out of just sheer boredom. You might watch it because there's nothing else on that you want to watch. We don't know how their charts work. We don't know how the charts on that thing work. We know how the charts on Spotify and Apple work. It's basically down to like volume of actual listens. There's nothing proportional about it. So do you get what I mean?
But there's an interesting analogy here, because the reason why Netflix spends so much money on their own content is not because they think it brings in an equivalent number of subscribers. It's because they have the existential threat of, well, what if everyone with the rights to the stuff stops leasing it to us?
Exactly.
So they're paying over the top to give themselves the security of, even if everyone goes away, we have great content.
And that is where the writers' strike in the States at the moment is so interesting, right? And that is why, essentially, the PGA Tour and LIV Golf argued over its writers. Like, the people who made the storylines. Now, the writers, you can just say, are crew in general, right? They could be directors, they could be any of these things. There's a writer's strike at the moment. It's hard to make a compelling film without good writers. And the golfers, the people who play left wing and right wing for your football club, are the writers of the story.
But back to your point, it's weird for the Saudis to be getting that wrong in the context of LIV, because they're cheap writers. It's
writers, to get a writer for a day and make a writer's room, that's the key to getting a script together, right? And the problem at the moment is that, and part of the dispute in the writer's room dispute right now is, well, you get us to do a month of writer's room, but what used to happen on movies is they used to take writers to set, right? And now they don't want to do that anymore. They just want to shoot the film as it was written. But the problem with not having writers on set is, on the day on set, and I know this, having directed stuff, things change. Props come along that someone goes, oh, that we wrote this giant banana joke, and that's not a giant banana. That's like a normal sized banana. This doesn't work anymore. And then you can't shoot the joke anymore. But the whole plot hinges on that. On the day, you want a writer on set that goes, it's cool, we can write around this. Do you know what we'll do? We will make the joke that he thinks it's a giant banana. And then they go around that, right?
You know what the exact equivalent is? Mm-hmm. You used to spend 25 million. This doesn't happen as much anymore. You'd spend 25 million on a centre forward and not spend 50 grand making sure he has kids for his school, for his kids,
yeah,
his wife has someone to learn the language with,
yeah,
put him in, and used to blow the 20 mil because you wouldn't spend the 50 grand.
Yeah,
the same is true here.
Exactly. And you're not giving him the coach that helps him hit the back of the net.
I mean, that's
mad.
Like, now you'll have like player liaison officers, right, whose job it is. But there's a Harry Redknapp story where I can't remember, a Paraguayan center half, I want to say after the 2006 World Cup, and he, you know, they don't pick him up from the airport, so he's now not at the training ground, and he's freaked out. He jumps out of his hotel window to get a flight back to first floor, nothing dark, to clarify. But he Harry's knocking on the door and he goes, oh, 1 second, and sneaks out and takes the first plane back to Paraguay.
Wow.
That's the equivalent of not paying your writers, or right. in the live context, not paying the cameraman, or in the extreme case, Steven Spielberg, to say, you know, when Morgan Freeman did the Qatar opening ceremony?
Yeah.
That was kind of the right idea.
Yeah. I mean, it was roughly the right idea. Morgan Freeman at the time had terrible PR, and I think so he was sort of cheap. But like, I get your point. Like, it was sort of like, oh, look, a voice that bridges both cultures, right? And that's part of, I don't know, we should probably find a way of concluding this, right? But what I'm saying is, like, it's going to come down to marketing as much as it is legal. And part of it is that the better marketed league, the better marketed product will win. Like, if Liver come along and marketed it properly, it might be them swallowing up the PGA.
But you know what's interesting about this too, and we will wrap this up, is in the dating app market, you have Tinder, who is the PGA, if you like. Less classy, you might argue.
Nice,
but,
sure.
But the market dominator.
Is Hinge more like the PGA? Yeah.
Also, Hinge...
Tinder's the original, is what you're saying.
That's probably
technically
better.
Technically, Grindr's the original. But you get my point, right?
I take the point.
Yeah.
But then you have this app, and this could have been Liv. You have this dating app called Thursday.
Uh-huh.
And Thursday launched with not that much money, but their premise was kind of interesting. It only worked on the Thursday. So the app wouldn't work 6 days a week. And you have to chat and meet on the Thursday.
Okay, so I've heard about this app. Right, that makes sense.
But their Instagram was so good.
Right.
It was aesthetic. It was funny. It was like memey. Like something happened this week, it would reference it.
Right.
Marketing, good marketing is cheap mm-hmm. relative to paying Ronaldo. And it seems awfully strange, as you say, that you go pay Ronaldo, but don't get whoever's running Thursday's Instagram account.
So that's what's really fascinating to me, right? And that's partially why the kind of the... That's partially why Arsene Wenger was so successful in football at one time, right? The reason Arsene Wenger was so successful in football was he had the right scouting network. And the scouting network knew where to look for value. Liverpool became successful in football because they had a good scouting network and they knew where to look for value. It's about finding that value somewhere. And by the way, value is not just monetary value, right? Like the value that Liverpool's scouting network, when they first came to Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp offered, was... The value of a Mane or a Salah, and to an extent a Firmino, is not just how do they return on the field. It's where's their potential meets, if they reach that potential, how likely are they to stick around or go to Real Madrid or do whatever, not be led astray to go and do parties. Oh, all three of them are really good family religious men who don't go anywhere else. Right, we've done our scouting. We've done our background research on those guys.
And we suspect they'll peak 2 years into a 5-year contract, right. Meaning we can give them another contract then.
Correct.
They're not going to peak right at the end and then go off to United.
Exactly. And that's kind of my point here, is like, it's strategically, it's been bad for PGA. Strategically, it's been bad for Liv. But it maybe it doesn't harm the product in the short term, because I think maybe they've patched things up,
and
should we say?
And look, they'll get it right too. Like, I don't doubt that they'll get it right in time. They have consultants worrying about this stuff. But I think the takeaway here really is, like, it looks like there's been a misdiagnosis of where the value lives.
And that's what's fascinating about it. Their diagnosis was, and it's such a political approach to such an non-political idea, if that makes sense. So they've gone, oh, this is how power is exerted. This is how power works. We go in there, we own this, you acquiesce. And then when they've got in there, the fans have gone, no, that's not how that works. Like, that we aren't going to watch your product because it's poor or whatever it is. And maybe it kind of worked in football because they just bought the institutions, and maybe it's kind of working in some other things. But like, they've forgotten the soft skills, is what I'm saying. They've forgotten the flavor in the pasta.
Or we're underestimating just how little it matters because Ronaldo's so popular.
Sure.
I don't think that's a good argument, by the way, but I mean, it's interesting, right? Like, how much marketing do you need to do if you have Ronaldo, Benzema? And I think the answer is quite a lot still, because you're still competing with the Premier League.
Correct.
And La Liga and Serie A.
And no one wants to see, like, so what they did was they looked at the other circus and they went, oh, they've got that big elephant. Let's buy the big elephant. But they forgot, like, everything else, that, like, the candy floss is really good at that circus, right?
And also, for what it's worth, that elephant was way better 10 years ago.
100%. Like, and sure, like, that's a whole other sporting thing. But, like, you get what I'm saying here. Like, there's, like, a... How can I put it? Like, they've just misinterpreted and misconstrued...
The low-hanging fruit.
Yes. And the low-hanging fruit is still there. Like, you know, I'm still very much open to consultancy with the Saudis. But like, you get my point. Like,
this has been the longest CV of all time.
And I've shown I probably don't understand what your actual existential problems are, right? But you get my point. Like,
yeah.
How does that work?
Look, they'll get it right. There's no doubt. With enough concentration and prioritization, they'll get the marketing stuff right.
That's kind of what Man City have done, though, isn't it? Like, Man City kind of got it right in the end.
Brilliant example. But the first thing they did, and this is kind of a defense, this is the argument against what we've been saying, City didn't go in and buy Robinho after getting the marketing right. They thought, Jesus, let's just get top four and pay Rocky Santa Cruz too much money.
I love that.
And we'll work it out afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look, inevitably, it's not going to matter because they'll get it right. But Jesus, in the short term, I think your assessment is bang on.
Pep Guardiola is so key to Man City working, though. So Pep Guardiola is, in essence, like pure football. And I know you can make an argument that he isn't. But in essence, there is pure football about him. He comes from the heritage of Barcelona that is intertwined with Cruyff, which is intertwined with what made football, in the modern sense, football. He's a global guy. You know, he could probably be a manager in South America, all these kind of things. When Pep leaves Man City, I think there is a bit of a, there's got to be a roadmap. They must have roadmapped it. But, and maybe they'll still build on his principles. But it's very difficult to keep that going after that. So he's the consultant right now. He's the PR guy for them because football is being used as PR. When you stop winning in that fashion, you know, what then? What do you become then? Like, and I guess your kind of point with the arc and the justice thing and all those kind of things is like the position might have changed in that time. In 10 years, they'll be in a different spot. So maybe they don't need Pep then. Pep is key to now.
What City will need, and I use the word need, in a footballing sense and a PR sense, is not the same today as it will be in 10 years.
Right.
They're three European Cups away from being a different thing.
Yeah. And being acknowledged by everyone else.
Well, look, I mean, Chelsea at this point are... So Arsenal are the biggest club in London, in my view, but Chelsea are right in there, and you could argue it both ways. Mm-hmm. That's not the same... They don't have the same set of priorities as they did when Roman Abramovich took over.
Yeah, right.
And in terms of the footballing thing, I actually think City will be okay. It'll take them a little, it'll be bumpy because Pep will leave at the same time as De Bruyne. Blah, blah, blah. But no, I think before you get too vicariously concerned on City's behalf, I think they're just three European Cups away from it not mattering.
On an existential level, I think it will always matter. But I think on the PR level, I think you're correct.
Yeah, I mean, you just graduate to a level. You know, Apple have so much capital that they could, without selling a computer, produce billions a year just on the 5% off the markets.
Right.
They have that much sitting there.
Yeah.
Football clubs become that to some degree.
Yeah.
Man United's revenue has just gone, even as they've been rubbish. City will have to work it out. But the more established they become and the more normalized they become, the less hard push you have to do as Abu Dhabi.
So I guess that's kind of also interesting from that perspective because I don't want to kind of get too deep in this. Whether you believe the charges are real or not against Man City is kind of irrelevant in this conversation. The charges are still there, right? And Man City or the people running Man City, they don't ignore them. But what they are doing is similar to what's happening with PGA and LIV, right? Is they're basically going, we are in this space and we're going to force your hand and you're going to change and something bad is going to happen to you. It's almost like mutually assured destruction in a sense. Like they went, you'll lose, but we'll lose and we're happy to lose because we've got all the money. We'll just keep going.
It's better to apologize and ask for forgiveness than ask for permission.
Right.
And if you're Man City, from a PR point of view, dude, take the 100 charges, be guilty of all of them and just absorb that. Doesn't matter.
But that's kind of my point. You're not missing the point, but that does miss the point of football to so many people. And if you can't walk into your local pub, if you can't walk into your local place and go, yeah, but we won the title that year, with little more than basically people going, yeah, but you bought that striker and that's why you won it. That's really problematic in football. You're missing that point of like, the essence of it is you won, you know, and you get to revel in that victory. But if you're to take it back to where we were, if you won because of some outside force, you didn't win.
That matters to me and that matters to you. It doesn't, I'm sure, matter to Abu Dhabi.
And that kind of, yeah, and that's a really good point because, you know, even when someone said to me during the time, I don't know if the charges are true or not. I'm sure everyone's done something wrong in the Premier League, but I'm sure they're also, Man City may have, had some issues along the way. I don't even know. But when someone said to me like, well, so do you want Liverpool to have those titles back? I was like, not really. Like, I don't, you know, as much as it might be a funny video for a few weeks, like it might benefit me financially, maybe.
Might be nice to get one over United. Ha,
yeah,
ha.
Yeah, we get one over on the other teams. I don't get the parade. I don't get the moment shared with my dad or the moment shared with my kids or the moment shared with the people. You know, I don't get that moment in Anfield when everyone went, we won it. Like, we won due to that goal. I don't get Daniel Sturridge and Luis Suarez. I mean, Luis Suarez is, you know, maybe I don't want to celebrate with him, but I don't get Daniel Sturridge and Raheem Sterling on the pitch. Raheem Sterling then going, I can win things here. I don't need to go to Man City. Do you know what I mean?
Retrospective trophies are like, there's a reason why when someone wins a silver medal or a gold medal at the Olympics, that gets upgraded. They're still fuming. And the person that did the drugs goes, sorry, you didn't have your moment.
Yeah.
The moment matters much more than the on-paper achievement, which is why Twitter doesn't understand what it's on about.
Right, and that's a real problem, right? That's like a real... there's like a mass experience there that is kind of on steroids.
And as far as like Saudi Arabia or Abu Dhabi are concerned, they're the moments that matter. I mean, I'll go as far as to say this. You could strip City, I really mean this, of every title that they've won, and it would not go close to undoing the title wins as a right. PR point.
Yeah, it's almost a useless thing to do. But that shows that the money that has been invested can usurp the system.
If you're accused of a crime publicly that you're eventually cleared of, the damage has been done.
Right.
The same applies here, and these institutions are totally vulnerable for that reason and many others to the Saudi Arabian Abu Dhabi money. And it's why I suspect that influence is only going to grow. Look, you could turn around and say, we're going to take a stand as the government about golf. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any policy advisor in the government who would take you seriously.
Yeah, because they basically go, cool, we might as well just piss in the wind.
We have much bigger fish to fry.
Yeah.
And you know, like you get people, hostages to these governments on bullshit charges. And it's a headache for the government. It's a huge headache. Like, you have to do prisoner exchanges, you damage your reputations, and they think, Jesus, just don't get arrested by a terrorist organization because it like does huge... They're not going to pick a fight about golf.
And that's a really good point. And I think, you know, to kind of add to that, like, you know, I'm not saying, therefore, that the billionaires generated in England are good billionaires or that the people who are moneyed in this country are good. Like, you know, if you look enough into the train system in England, which everyone hates, like that has been humbled by Virgin and, you know, Richard Branson, who owns that, has, you know, consistently had legal battles with the government, which have taken taxpayers' money and all these kind of things. Billionaires historically don't really care about the institutions they're harming. They care about benefiting from those institutions.
One of the qualities that predicts a billionaire is going to end up being a healthy or unhealthy disrespect for authority and institutions.
Right.
Richard Branson's first plane, he flew because he was at an airport and they couldn't get back from holiday. He thought, Jesus, hang on, hands up if you jump on a small flight and chartered one. That's not a man who's going to be hugely respectful of institutions.
Yeah, and at the same time, those institutions represent normal everyday people. And the problem is, like, those normal everyday people lose.
To finish up on this, I think I'd like to strike an optimistic note. I think I'd struggle to do so. I think...
Oh, I thought you were going to say something really good then.
No,
go on.
I'm afraid I have nothing good to say apart from just a comment or to reflect that if you're wanting to predict something happening, you have to look at the conditions, and the conditions here are highly motivated, highly influential foreign powers, say, and highly vulnerable, highly interested institutions, a totally toothless regulatory body, the government running the thing, and all the individual incentives, the players, the pundits, the referees, the footballers, unbelievably excited to get involved over there. So I would be amazed if in 10 years' time we weren't having this conversation and going, oh, it's a full top four of Saudi Arabian sides. I was hoping that the I was hoping that the Abu Dhabians would have got a Champions League. I honestly think that'll be the conversation.
There is something to be said for the fact that, like, we can, like, we critiqued it here. I'm not sure that I said whether I agreed or disagreed. I mean, to an extent, I disagree with it going on. I don't like the way the system works. But I'm, like, also kind of morbidly curious about where it kind of goes. And, like, if it's going to happen, I'd rather help shape it than be completely disenfranchised by the situation and not experience sport. And that's kind of where they've got me here, is like, I want the sport. I want the thing to invest in. You've kind of got me here.
Well, here's two points, right? Like, one is everyone was like, oh, like, boo, World Cup. But it's the best thing in the world. So you're going to watch it.
Was it the best? I mean, that was part of maybe made me a little bit resentful, was I was like, I kind of felt a bit like I was watching it and I wasn't able to say, actually, this was good. Like, great final, really good final. Some of the bits a little bit, you know? And without people sort of going, oh, you're racist. Do you know what I mean?
Fully, but in any case, the strength of moral argument that came out to criticize it evaporates around the fact that, oh, Brazil are at 3 o'clock.
Mm.
But the second point is, and because we're talking about billionaires, Charlie Munger's famous thing of, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. The incentives on every level, individually, structurally, regulatory, is for this thing to get bigger and bigger.
Right.
So unless there's some huge change in incentive, which strange things have happened, I guess, I'm convinced you're going to have... Did you know Luton Town are one of only two non-state-owned clubs in the Premier League?
Right.
I mean, Opta is going to go full on, like, we're going to have the Abu Dhabi derby.
Right.
Even though it's like...
It's just going to be called the Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. Between Southampton and Middlesbrough. And it won't matter. Which is fine. You can get a ticket and watch your League One team. Which is legitimately like the safe...
And you take it back there. You
have no idea how many texts I got when the Super League was happening. Because all my mates support Chelsea. Because I grew up in West London. And I was thinking, Jesus, how many season tickets can I get here? And then when it didn't come off, I was secretly like, damn it.
Oh, I wish I could have gotten like...
Another season by myself.
Yeah. I mean, hey, I get it. Thanks a lot for listening, guys. It's been really good to spend some time with you. It was quite a detailed discussion we ended up having. Maybe some monologuing happened. If people want to find you or they're interested, what videos have you done over the last few weeks?
Following our conversation, I did one on Jose Mourinho.
Oh, yeah. But you were kind of working on that before we did Mourinho anyway. And then it worked as quite a nice follow-up.
Yeah, it did. It's about Jose Mourinho, in effect, throwing at European Cup semi-final.
Yeah.
Which sounds like sensationalized nonsense. I guarantee it isn't. But thank you for listening. This has been in-depth and winding, and I hope as much fun to listen to as it was to record.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been really interesting to chat to you as well. If you've got any feedback on the podcast or you want to help support it, the best thing you can do is A, recommend it to a friend or just say, hey, this is really good listen, or this was something I enjoyed. And secondly, it's also reviewing it on Apple and Spotify. What I found out the other day was, so there was only one review on it before we started because I uploaded a trailer ages ago. It was 5 stars. Someone did a 2-star review. But I think I couldn't see what it was because the app didn't work properly. What I'm saying is just go on the app and just hit 5 stars and maybe just write something really nice about it. Like, you know, if you can, that would be great. And I guarantee that the reviews that I put from this bit will be nice because no one who hates me listens an hour and a half into this and then says that, right? Jamie, thanks a lot for joining for the conversation. You're an interesting person.
Lawrence, thanks for having me, mate.
Yeah, head over to Jamie's YouTube channel and we will see you probably next time. I mean, very soon. Yeah, have a good one.
Cheers.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.com. KOSI.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to COSI. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to COSI starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at COSI.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to COSI. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to COSI starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at COSI.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to COSI. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to COSI starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at COSI.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to COSI. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to COSI starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at COSI.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.